Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Lung Cancer and Personalized Medicine. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 477 people on the call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions, and we also have international participants from Canada, France, Guam, India, Korea, Thailand, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And I want to acknowledge all of you as really clearly a group of information seekers. And I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about all of our speakers, and there's information also about the topics they'll be covering, and about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for you, and these are free resources for you to follow up with. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You're in the best position to tell us the programs we should offer. You're our best recommenders for topics that we should do moving forward or any programming that we should do. So tell us what you'd like us to do. We're going to try really hard. We try very hard to listen to you as participants in these programs. You're a wonderful resource for us to tell us really what we should be offering. Indeed, the program today was one that you've asked us to offer, this concept of personalized medicine. What is it? How does it apply to lung cancer? That's something that you all have asked us to offer. Now, today's program was made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and Inclome Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company, and really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we are very fortunate today to have such wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Criss is going to address an overview of lung cancer. He's going to talk about what is personalized medicine, the benefits of personalizing lung cancer treatments, and communicating with your healthcare team about symptom and pain management. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Criss.
Thank you, Carolyn. And again, it's my pleasure to speak to all of you today all over the U.S. and all over the world. This has been a very exciting time for the treatment of lung cancer, particularly in the last decade. Our care has improved substantially, both in its ability to better control cancer, to cure more patients, and to lead to benefits in treating symptoms in virtually every patient. Things have truly heated up in the last few years as we've come to the realization that by understanding specific characteristics of the tumor tissues that are removed from you in biopsy specimens, we can even better choose therapies and offer you therapies that are more effective and more safer to receive. So with that as a background, a few words about lung cancer in general. I'm talking today about cancers that arise in the lung. In all of oncology, illnesses are still treated based on the place of origin of the cancer. And again, the illnesses we're talking about today are those that arose in the lung. There can be some confusion. Many other cancers that arise in other parts of the body can spread to the lung, so-called metastasize to the lung. So, for example, you may have a cancer that arose in the breast, and it may spread to the bone or spread to the lung. Cancer of the breast that spread to the lung is not lung cancer. That's not our topic today. Secondly, there are cancers that arise from other structures in the chest that are not from the lung. And I think the two most common would be thymus cancer, thymoma, or cancer that arose from the lining of the chest cavity, the pleura, and that would be called mesothelioma. We're not talking about that today. So with all cancer, the most important first step is the diagnosis of cancer, and that's usually done by a biopsy, and I'll talk a little bit more about the importance of a biopsy. Once cancer is diagnosed, your team has to then decide what's the site of origin, and there are various tests that can be done on the tumor tissue to do that. And then lastly, what needs to be done is to figure out exactly precisely where the cancer is in the body of the person where it's been discovered, so-called staging, so-called extended disease evaluation, where various tests are done, scans of various parts of the body that say, is there cancer in different places in the chest or in different places in the body? These are really three distinct steps, and I ask you to kind of keep them separate in your own minds, diagnosing cancer, figuring out where it started, and then seeing where it is in the body. It's extremely important, and particularly in the treatment of lung cancer, to analyze those tumor tissues, do the testing that's necessary on those biopsy specimens to take first the two largest ways of differentiating lung cancer that leads to decision on treatment, and that is to say whether it's what they call small cell lung cancer or non-small cell. They're both pretty crummy names. Small because the cells look small under the microscope, non-small because the cells didn't look like the small cells they saw under the microscope. They are really just sort of terms. It's like the color red. What does red mean? It really doesn't mean anything, but you know what red is. So once you've decided, you've made the diagnosis of cancer, you've made the diagnosis of lung cancer, you know where it is in the body, you have to decide on the primary treatment. And we have three primary treatments. The first is surgery, removing the pieces of cancer that we discover, radiation, administering a killing dose of radiation, X-ray treatments to that cancer that's discovered. And the third group are so-called systemic therapies, chemotherapy, targeted therapy, basically drugs that are taken by the persons with cancer. The drugs go everywhere in the body, and they're really used in two ways. They're used to either supplement the benefits of surgery or radiation, and in that setting, they can not only lead to a longer life, but give you a greater chance of being cured of your cancer. The second way they're used is to be the sole treatment of cancer, and usually when a cancer has left the confines of the lung, surgery or radiation to that spot in the lung is no longer helpful to you, and the best treatment for you is going to be a systemic therapy or chemotherapy. The critical point, though, is the target of that treatment, whether it's given with surgery or whether it's given by itself. Systemic therapy treats hidden cancer, treats metastases, either tries to prevent metastases, treat hidden metastases, or actually treat the metastases that you can see. So that's the goal of treatment. I'll start with a few words on the difference between treatment of small cell and non-small cell lung cancer. Again, it's decided pathologically. Small cell lung cancer is treated with chemotherapy, and each and every case, it is also treated with radiation, either radiation to the tumor in the lung, if indeed the cancer is confined to the lung and the adjacent lymph nodes. Also, in those persons that have a good response with chemotherapy, we give radiation treatments to the brain, preventative radiation treatments to the brain, so-called PCI, prophylactic cranial irradiation, to prevent the spread of this cancer to the brain, which can happen in quite a few situations. Small cell lung cancer is about 13% of lung cancer. The rest is what we call non-small cell lung cancer. Now, within non-small cell lung cancer, there are really two major types. There is the squamous type, and that's about a quarter of the non-small cell cases, and then the adenocarcinoma type, and there's about three-quarters of the cases fall into that group. Making that decision is extremely important because it decides which chemotherapy drugs can be more successful or safe, and there are two specific examples there. The agent bevacizumab and a therapy that targets the blood growth in cancerous tumors. It's been found to be unsafe in patients with squamous cell cancer. So that differentiation of squamous versus not is very important in the use of bevacizumab. It's also important in the selection of certain chemotherapy agents. We know that in a large clinical trial, that patients with squamous cancer had a much better result with the agent bevacizumab over the agent pemetrexed. In patients with adenocarcinoma, just the opposite was true. The pemetrexed gave a better result than the bevacizumab, than the gemcitabine. So it's very important for your doctor to know that and to use that in the recommendation to you. So what is personalized medicine? It is basically making the choice of a treatment for you. It's not treating a specific illness. It's not treating a certain type of tissue. Even the different pathologic tests is not exactly how that would work out. What is important is that the best treatment is chosen for you. And it comes up in two different ways. The first is the choice of the multimodality care. Do you recommend surgery? Do you recommend radiation? Do you recommend chemotherapy with it? What's the order of this testing? That's part of personalized medicine, and that's usually done by what we call a multimodality or multi-specialty care team. All the different specialists literally sit down together and talk about the available treatments, choose the treatments, choose the order of treatments specifically for your particular case. Also taking into account special issues about your general health. For example, a drug like cisplatin, which we would often use, causes hearing loss, particularly in people that already have pre-existing hearing loss. That kind of a fact would need to be known in the team because we would not be recommending a drug like cisplatin to somebody that could have further hearing damage and have their quality of life impaired. So what are the benefits of personalized lung cancer treatments? I think first, it does more than anything else fulfill a goal that all physicians have, and I think that a goal that our patients have set for us, and that is, doctor, choose the best therapy for me. Choose the therapy that is most likely to help me. And that by this personalized approach, that's exactly what we do. What we also do in that, and this is not quite as good, but it is helpful, is that we know that if the characteristic is there that allows you, a characteristic that helps you choose a therapy is not present, it means that it is very unlikely that that therapy would help you. So we recommend an alternative. And that, again, that's important because it spares you from getting a therapy that has virtually no chance of helping you and yet could cause side effects and gets you quicker to a therapy with a better likelihood. So it helps in both ways. And I know many people are disappointed when one of these genetic tests is done. It comes back not showing that genetic factor. But that's a good point because it spares you from getting a treatment that's not going to help and it can cause its own side effects. Again, what are the benefits? Generally, on these personalized approaches, we have better success. We also can advise you better about what to expect because we, again, have matched that treatment to you, and we use all the knowledge we have to do that. I would like to just spend a few minutes also talking about communication with your healthcare team, and particularly communication with symptom and pain management. I think it's very important when you start your relationship with your healthcare team that you talk things through and set some ground rules about communication. You need to understand who the contact people are in your the physician's office, for example, and the physician needs to understand who's your team. You need to establish your own team and make it very clear that this is the person I'm turning to help me make decisions. I think it's very important in doctor visits to have somebody with you, somebody that has your trust and your confidence. You really need what many people call a second set of ears, somebody else to keep notes while you're trying to listen hard. You really need to identify somebody that would you feel comfortable having with in all the tough decision-making that needs to be done, and also that they are comfortable being with you during these sometimes very difficult to understand and sometimes emotional times. I think the second thing, and this is a more practical one, you also need at the very beginning to choose what we would call a surrogate. You know, in each state there are different rules. I know here in the state of New York there is a form where people designate who is to speak for them if they cannot speak for themselves. And it is very, very important that you do that. You need to make that choice. Nobody else can make it for you. And it's very helpful for your whole healthcare team to know who that person is and develop a relationship with them as well, because they need to know the medical facts to help make the best decisions for you. And the healthcare team needs to know who they can turn to if for some reason you're not available. I mean, the best way I explain this to patients is the same way that our government functions, that if the president needed to have anesthesia, we have a very clear line of authority if the president cannot speak at that very moment, and it's the same sort of issue for you. A couple of things that help on a practical level, when you go see your healthcare team, make a list of the things that are you want answered that day. Also, please prioritize that list. You know that things happen in the course of a busy visit, and you need to make sure that the questions you need answered, the most important question gets answered and gets answered first, and you get to as many of those other questions as you can or as the circumstances allow. The other thing I would urge you to remember, and this is sort of not so much even about medicine but about life in general, is that I call the rule of three. For some crazy reason, no matter how many things need to be attended to, it's generally the first three that need to be done. Or if you ask people to remember a list of things, it's generally the first three. So please make sure when you have questions or issues that are critical to you, things you need answered on the day of that visit, put that in the first three things on your list, because you're much more likely to get that answer. And again, you don't want to leave that clinic visit until you get that information you really need. With regard to symptom management, I think it's very critical that whatever your symptom is, be it pain from a biopsy that you had, be it pain from the cancer, be it swelling of a leg from a deep vein thrombosis, these are the things that impact the quality of your life, and they happen at every point in your care, from that very first visit to a visit 10 years out after you're cured of your cancer. And it's extremely important to take care of those symptoms and make sure your doctor and whatever other healthcare team members are there to help do that. Symptoms determine your quality of life, and many patients tell me that it's quality that is really the most important consideration for them, and I really believe that, and you have to pay attention to that. The second thing, and this is sort of a practical one, is that for symptoms, it's only you that can declare a symptom and only you that can quantitate it. No one can tell another human being how much pain they're in. No one can tell another human being how much nausea they have. That is only something that they know, and they need to tell the healthcare providers when they have a problem. They need to do their best to quantitate it, and we need to learn from you what those symptoms are. So to close now, we've talked about lung cancer treatment, about the great opportunities we have here in personalized medicine, how we have now so many ways of fighting lung cancer that we need to put all of our forces to bear in the care of each and every patient. Dr. Sequest, I think, is going to be talking to you now about some very specific ways in which this is done in the treatment of lung cancer. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris. Just an outstanding, really, presentation, and also just going into all of the details of care and that important part about the communication with the healthcare team and having the surrogate and having all of one's quality of life attended to. So thank you. It's very important messages, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Alicia Sequist, and Dr. Sequist is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. And Dr. Sequist is going to address how personalized medicine is redesigning your care, gene profiling, the important role of clinical trials, and quality of life issues, nutritional concerns, and tips. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Sequist.
Thanks, Carolyn, and I'd like to echo Dr. Chris' statement of what a pleasure it is to be here with all of you. Thank you for taking the time to call in from all around the world. And I'm going to give a brief overview now of some of the new developments in personalized medicine in lung cancer, particularly relating to something we call genotype. So genotype is just a way of saying what an individual cancer cell status is when it comes to certain genes. Genes are made up by DNA, and we have genes that we inherit from our mom and our dad and pass on to our children. But when we talk about cancer genotype, it's a little bit different. We're not talking about those genes that run in the family. There are other genes that occur only in the cancer cells, not in the rest of the cells in the body. And these genes are often in charge of running the cancer, making it grow, making it spread. And what we try and do nowadays is try and take advantage of knowing what those genes are and put the brakes on. Stop cancers from growing and stop cancers from spreading by shutting down the genes that run them. Speaking about non-small cell lung cancer specifically, we think that a good proportion of non-small cell lung cancers are driven by a specific gene or genotype. And we're learning more and more each year about how to test patients and the cancers from our patients for these gene profiles so that we can figure out what the best potentially most active therapy might be for that patient. And so this is really redesigning the way that we think about cancer from the time of diagnosis through all the different treatment steps. Nowadays it's very important to consider that genotyping might be done even when you're doing the very first biopsy that may diagnose something that ultimately is a lung cancer. It does take a certain amount of tissue or piece of the cancer itself in order to get these tests done. And, you know, before this explosion in knowledge about genotype, the field was actually going towards smaller and smaller biopsies, trying to figure out what type of cancer you had by taking the smallest piece possible because it was thought that that might be safer, less invasive. But what we're realizing now, I think we've kind of swung back over the last 5 years towards trying to get as large biopsies as is safe and feasible, because there is just precious information in those cancer cells that can tell us, you know, it's not only about research or pie in the sky. It really comes down to the best therapy for you, and your doctor at your local hospital can use that information to help select the best treatments for you. There are several different types of genes that we look for to see what their status is or their genotype is in non-small cell lung cancer. And I won't go through the whole list of what they are because a lot of them sound like alphabet soup. They all have different letters. I will say that probably the two most important as of today are something called EGFR and something called ALK, A-L-K. And the reason these two are most important is because we have drugs now, FDA-approved drugs, that can treat both these types of cancers. If there's a mutation in EGFR, one of the best therapies that we have at our hands is a pill called erlotinib, which is also known by the name Tarceva. And if we find that the cancer actually has something called a translocation in the ALK gene, there's another pill that's now FDA approved just 2 weeks ago called crizotinib, which also goes by the name Xalkori. Now, we think these are two of many more to come. There are many other genes that may be mutated or changed in lung cancers, and there are many other drugs that may effectively shut down those cancers that carry those mutations. And the way that we're learning about these different types of situations and how to best direct patients toward appropriate care is through clinical trials. I imagine that some of the people on this call have heard of clinical trials, participated in clinical trials even, but there may be people on the call who don't know really what it means to be in a clinical trial. And so I'll just spend a minute to say that clinical trial is a broad and general term. It could mean a lot of different specific things. Clinical trials come in many different phases. They can be early trials of a drug that hasn't been tried in many people before, sometimes even hasn't been tried in any people before. That would be a first-in-man trial. And then clinical trials can go up into later stages of development where you're looking at hundreds and sometimes even thousands of patients treated with a drug or a new combination of two drugs. And so to participate in a clinical trial can mean a lot of different things, but in general it means that you're getting a therapy that is not a standard therapy, that is in some way experimental. And there can be a large range in the degree of experimentalness, if that's a word, of the clinical trial. Now, I think historically, doctors and people in general may have thought of phase one trials as something that was sort of a last a last-ditch hope. These are the first trials of a drug, the earliest stage of drug development. But the really exciting thing in lung cancer lately is that even phase one trials can be extremely successful if they are done in a way that takes advantage of the genotype of the cancer. And so I mentioned briefly that there was a brand new FDA-approved drug, crizotinib, for patients with this ALK translocation. The backbone of why that drug got FDA approved in record time, really, was because of a phase one trial, that was supposed to be looking at what's the best dose to give this drug, what's the best schedule, and what does the safety look like. But collaboration of a lot of different scientists in both academic centers and in the pharmaceutical companies, I think that people realized early on that this drug might work especially well in a select group of people. And so those patients that had that marker were tried on the drug even in a phase one trial, and the results were extremely successful. And I think that's really the direction that lung cancer research is going, trying to, even from the first days of testing the safety and finding the right dose of the drug, really trying to personalize it and find patients most likely to benefit so that they have a chance to try these new therapies that are coming down the pike. Now, not all clinical trials are necessarily geared toward one genotype or another, and there are many clinical trials out there that can be very successful for multiple types of patients. And so I urge you all to talk to your doctors at home about clinical trials, about whether they have clinical trials or whether they can refer you to a nearby center that does have clinical trials, because this is really how we move the field forward and how we get patients access to the most cutting-edge treatments. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention for sure before we go to the question session is that, you know, we've talked a lot today, or at least I have, about these kind of high-tech tests and looking at the genes and thinking about, what's really going on at the cellular level in the cancer. But I think it's also important to remember and to step back and take a look at the big picture of what's going on. There's research looking into quality of life nowadays, too, and that is something that's equally as important as the molecular targeting of drugs. And in fact, this past year, there was a large study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that when a special team of doctors that are knowledgeable in pain and symptom management and improving quality of life get involved and team up with cancer doctors to take care of cancer patients, that it helps improve all kinds of things for the cancer patients. It helps with lower the rates of depression. It helps improve the quality of life quite tremendously, actually, and it may even improve survival for people with cancer. So I think that oncologists are really embracing more and more the need to work hand-in-hand with other specialists and other care providers and make sure that their patients have the state-of-the-art treatment as far as pain, coping, staying nutrition, making sure to avoid malnutrition, staying hydrated during all of these chemotherapies and different treatments, really controlling anxiety, depression. All of this is key to getting the best outcomes for our patients. With that, I think we can take it to the next step. We have a few more minutes, and then we'll open for questions, I think.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Sequest. Just a wonderful presentation and so informative and lots of information for everybody to take the complex and make it so much more understandable for everybody on the call. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Our next speaker is Wynn Burkle, and Wynn is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. He's Director of Social Service of Long Island, and he's a lung cancer program coordinator for Cancer Care. And Wynn is going to address the free psychosocial support services that you can access from Cancer Care and also the role of lung cancer support groups. Wynn?
Thanks, Carolyn. I'm sure most of us remember the time that we moved into our first new home, or even our last new home, and I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. You know, being diagnosed with lung cancer is in some ways very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into this strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as the first stop for people who find themselves in the new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. Using simple-to-understand language in a user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them learn about the basic facts on lung cancer, how it can be prevented, different types of lung cancer, how it's detected and screened, stages of lung cancer and treatments for lung cancer, and the terms used in talking about the cancer. And there's a special section on clinical trials, which we've been discussing today, which not only help one learn what they're all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding a lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in a clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trials manager to help them with that whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Services such as education through our many Connect Education workshops, such as what we're engaged in today, and they provide both disease and specific information. And we also have workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge in a pack with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we've distributed almost 3 million of these very popular publications. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly e-newsletter. Services such as support. Cancer Care's professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of lung cancer, including emotional issues in which the staff is able to assess clients and provide appropriate, helpful psychosocial interventions, and dealing with practical issues such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program and referrals to Cancer Care's copay foundation and other financial assistance resources. Resource referral to the many organizations and agencies established to help cancer patients. Information on navigating the system, understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in healthcare, and the new communications necessary to be able to communicate in that environment. Oftentimes, our work is to help with the social issues as far as dealing with the cancer's impact among family members, friends, the community, and the workplace. Our social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as individual counseling in the New York Tri-State metropolitan area, and online and telephone counseling beyond that area. They assist in support groups, which, again, in the Tri-State area are face-to-face, and online and telephone for folks outside of that area. You know, we're talking about support groups. There's never a wrong time to join a support group, whether it's when you're newly diagnosed or whether you're in treatment. Whatever at point you're dealing with things, the support group is there to be of assistance. Now, here at Cancer Care, we recognize that the continuum of the lung cancer experience is significantly long, and so we're looking at establishing support groups for folks who are currently in active treatment for lung cancer, as well as support groups that will look at people who are post-treatment and want to continue to have that assistance and reassurance. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor we've been talking about, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Wynn, and thank you for just that rather really eloquent description of our services, and that Cancer Care is your good neighbor, and please do contact us if we can give any help with any of the concerns you may have. And now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, and Mary, if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many questions as we can.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
I have a question actually from one of our online participants, and the question is, what if my doctor says that I can't have another biopsy? What should I do? Dr. Sequest, could you address that question?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. You know, that's a great question because some of the participants may have been thinking as I was speaking about how we often do this on the first biopsy that's even taken. Well, what if they're already past that point? Presumably most of the people on this call are past that point. What should I do? How can I get this genetic testing? And sometimes what we do is we go back and we take that biopsy, which might be stored in a pathology department in a hospital somewhere, and we try and do the testing on it. If it doesn't seem to have enough tissue or it's already been used up in the process of getting the diagnosis, we often do recommend getting another biopsy. There certainly could be a situation where someone is not able to have a biopsy. Their cancer may be located in a place that's hard to reach. They may have some other sort of medical reason why they could not undergo a biopsy, but I think that's really the minority. Most lung cancer patients actually can have another biopsy. You just have to figure out what's the safest and best way to do it. And that is something that I often recommend to patients who come for a second opinion at my center is I say, let's get another biopsy. Let's try and figure out what's going on with the genes in your cancer so that we can see if there is a treatment that might be more specific to your cancer.
Excellent. Okay. Another question that often comes up, one of our online participants has also asked that question as well, is for the caregiver perspective, when someone is taking care of someone with lung cancer, a mom who has stage four lung cancer, I'd like to have some more information about how to handle and deal with chemotherapy side effects. So, Sequest, could you address that?
That the caregiver needs more information about
the side
effects?
Yeah, just in terms of, so they would be much more aware of just dealing with side effects, just general information that they could be aware of in terms of dealing with the side effects.
No, that's a great question. Whatever treatment you're on, it's very important to know what side effects might be anticipated so that you can know how to treat them. And also, if it's something that you weren't told about, you need to really communicate with your healthcare team and let your doctor or their team know what's going on with you, because it could be the early signs of some sort of problem that can be nipped in the bud. So, I mean, each drug is different, but many cancer drugs cause fatigue. A lot of cancer treatments cause nausea, and some may cause disruptions of the bowel, either diarrhea or constipation. And in addition to coming up with lots of new cancer treatments, I think the field has really moved forward by having a better understanding of how to treat some of these side effects. And so, I don't think we can go into a discussion of each of these side effects, but I do want you to know that there are treatments readily available for most of these side effects that can help improve quality of life. But the key is communication with your doctor back and forth, letting them know what side effects you're having. Is this normal? What can I do to prevent this next cycle of chemo? That's really important.
I'll particularly speak about nausea and throwing up. Our newer generation of cancer drugs in general have that much less of a side effect, and the drugs we have to prevent those prevent the symptoms are very effective and very safe. So I think for many people that's their number one concern, and those things are addressed. The last thing is that we have such access to information nowadays. There are very nice descriptions of side effects for every anti-cancer drug just available on the Internet. And I know, Lisha, I'm sure you have it at Mass General as well. we institutionally have made special descriptions of the different chemotherapy drugs. So whenever a specific chemotherapy is proposed, there's information available to the patient and to their caregivers. And I would urge you to be a little careful. Just we're talking about personalized medicine today. You have to be careful about side effects because not every drug causes side effects, and the side effects are very different person to person. So be very careful and get precise information about the drug you or your loved one's going to receive, and talk it through with your healthcare doc or nurse, and also know that the side effects can vary person to person.
And also, could we comment also, and Wynn might want to comment on this, but where do you go to get that information? Because certainly going to a healthcare team and the institution that you're being treated at, but if people are going to do a random Google search, where might these sites to go? Now, you have, of course, in your materials, all the organizations that we've listed here that all have websites and have really good information. Of course, there's always the National Cancer Institute. But some caution about where you get this information. And Wynn, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think one of the best sites for information on dealing with side effects is ASCO's cancer.net. They have an excellent listing of and a fairly comprehensive listing of most of the major side effects and what can be done about them, and also they do caution that the importance if something persists to be make sure that you talk with your treating physician on it. So I think citing the web is a great starting point. I think sometimes it can be helpful also to go to the website of the compound's manufacturer. They often will also have information on side effects and their palliation.
Just to put in a plug for cancer.net, too, there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of out there on the Internet. The American Society of Clinical Oncology, which prepares cancer.net, went to a lot of effort to bring in experts, but not just physicians, nurses, pharmacists, social work, patient advocates, a huge amount of effort to get the information appropriate and vetted by experts.
And that's so important, really. So please take that point away, everyone on the call. It's very important where you get the information from. Okay, our next question, Mary?
Our next question comes from Karen D.
Yes, my question is, my husband's on Alimta right now, and he had such bad side effects from nausea to vomiting to a gastro, and it's now over 3 weeks, and he did not get his last treatment because of his weakness, and he's still struggling to eat. What do I do? How can I help him?
Okay, well, thank you for that question. Dr. Sequest, do you want to address that?
Yeah, we see people that are coming in that are suffering with symptoms like this, and I'm sorry that your husband's not feeling well. That is really challenging. One of the things that I do when I have a patient who's not able to eat and they're having a lot of nausea and vomiting is give IV fluids. So I don't know if he's gone in to get some IV fluids, but that's probably a first step. And that often just means going to clinic, not staying overnight in the hospital. IV fluids can really help help you feel better and also reverse that dehydration. You can give IV medicines as well, anti-nausea medicines that can kind of break the cycle that he's in. So I think going in for some fluids sounds like the best thing.
I could also add to that, and please remember that while cancer treatments like radiation or chemotherapy cause the side effect of appetite loss and nausea, there are many other causes for those symptoms in persons with cancer. Generally, when those symptoms happen right around the treatment, you can usually incriminate them. But the further you get away from your treatment, and it sounds like in this situation it's been many weeks after the treatment, you really need to think about all the possible causes, very often another medication or some other kind of health problem. So I think it's very important that you meet with your health care team and that you go over all the possible causes of this problem. You can't just, blame the chemo.
Could you just address the concept, then, of a differential diagnosis? So how do you, as physicians, Dr. Sequest and Dr. Chris, determine some of the things that you do or think about and that our audience should be aware of, just as you've said, Dr. Chris, that they really should be aware that sometimes it's not just from the chemo.
Well, I think that's why a lot of times we like to see patients in the office. Talking on the phone is a great way to take care of some simple problems, and you can solve some things over the phone and call in prescriptions. But more often than not, oncologists would like to see their patients face-to-face so that they can take their vital signs, find out if they have a fever, find out what their blood pressure is and their heart rate, and examine them and see see how their lungs sound, see how their belly feels, see if their mouth looks dry, if there are signs of dehydration. And that helps us put together what you mentioned, Carolyn, which is a differential diagnosis. And we think of all the different things which might be going on and if there are tests we want to order to try and narrow down that differential diagnosis and how we would treat the patient to make them feel better.
Also, just a tip on how we think. I mean, in many ways, it's pattern recognition. And probably the most important set of facts that guides a doctor in their decision-making is what the patient tells them and what the answers are to the questions that the doctor asks them. I know there's a feeling nowadays that you just do some scan and you get the answer. Well, the truth is there are a lot easier ways to get the answer. They're probably more accurate than the scan. And it's simply by talking to you and listening to you and asking you the right questions. So, again, I know people often get upset that doctors and nurses keep asking the same questions, but this is exactly how we learn, and this is how we really make our decisions more than anything else. Leisha, do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very commonly someone will say, well, the nurse just asked me that. But I do try and explain, too, that, well, I need to ask you again so that I can go through my own thought process to figure out how to help you.
Yeah.
This is very refreshing for everybody on the call to know that the more somebody asks you or the more different disciplines ask, that's a good thing because everybody is figuring this out in different ways, and it can only be to everyone's benefit. So if multiple members of the healthcare team ask you a question, it's to help you really to figure out what's going on. And it's also refreshing to hear that conversation is so important. I think people often think they're going to order a test. I think that's a very, very good point. Excellent. Wow.
But we know we need to hear it from you more than anybody else. It's like how it is playing telephone. You all know that game. It's so important for us to hear it from you and also to hear from you, what's the most important thing to you. Your doctor just needs to ask those questions to you. And again, I'll apologize if you've already been asked them by other people, but we really need to hear it.
Oh, this is excellent. Thank you. Our next question, Mary?
Our next question comes from Paula S.
Oh, hello. Thank
Hi,
you.
Paula.
This has been an extraordinary hour. A question for you. I was diagnosed with stage 1 lung cancer and had my upper left lobe removed successfully. I had a PET scan, thanks to my oncologist, who said, didn't look so hot. I don't like the way your blood looks. So I got the PET scan, and unfortunately, fluid has built up in the lower lobe. And on Monday, I will be going for a thoracentesis. Now, the fluid is not contiguous. My oncologist colleague said it was very much like grape-like. Now, when I asked my pulmonologist...
I'm going to ask you what your question is.
My question is, when I spoke with my pulmonologist, I said, well, what do I do now? And she said, well, it doesn't look very good. And I'm just curious, as far as a diagnosis is concerned, in all the expertise on these people who have been so extraordinary, what is their take on fluid buildup in remaining part of the lung?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question, of course, in a general way, since they don't have access to actually examine all your records and all that. So they're going to give you a kind of a general kind of understanding of what you're asking, and then we're going to very much advise you to go back to your treating healthcare team and, of course, talk with them some more about your concerns. Dr. Chris?
Yeah, you bring up two issues. The first is the need for what we call surveillance after you've had a successful surgery. We know that people that have had lung cancer already are at risk for getting other lung cancers, and we have prescribed times where we do tests to find out and make sure that there is no new evidence of cancer. So it's very important that you follow whatever prescribed scanning interval and type of scan your doctor recommends. The second thing is, if there is a question on one of these scans, go back to what I said at the beginning. You do not know what something is from a photo, a picture. It is a picture. To make a diagnosis, you need to perform a biopsy, and those tissues have to be examined by a pathologist. So I would be very cautious about making any pronouncements until all the testing is done, until all the information is in. And I urge you to follow carefully the advice of your docs in doing the testing. But scans do not, you can't diagnose any kind of a cancer. You can't diagnose cancer on a scan.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. We have another question from one of our online participants, just really about the fact that they often find themselves getting dehydrated after their treatments, and they don't quite know what to do. And so I wonder if we could just address that in a general way. And Dr. Sequest, I wonder if you could address that initially, and Dr. Chris, if you want to add to that.
Sure. I mean, I think that it is important with many of the drugs that we give for cancer to stay hydrated, both because it can sometimes lower the toxicity that's associated with the drug and because it's very important as far as feeling good and quality of life. So, you know, we often advise people who are getting cancer treatments to drink a lot of water and other beverages, especially in the several days right around when they're getting a chemo infusion, a few days before and a few days after. That's very important. But if you're not able to drink fluid for some reason, like we had that question from the other woman whose husband was having a lot of nausea and vomiting and wasn't able to keep things down, that's a call that you need to put into your doctor's office and let them know that you're not able to stay hydrated. What do they advise?
Excellent. And that question, Ashley, that came in, Ashley, for Wynn, in terms of support groups. And the person is asking, like, when should I join a support group, and how do I know when I should do that?
Well, as I had mentioned earlier, it's important to join a support group at any point in your cancer experience. We have folks that join immediately after they've been told, and sometimes even before there's a workup on stages or things like that. Other folks find that as they are facing the prospect of treatment, they come to support groups primarily initially just for the sense of getting some information from folks who have been there and done that, but they often reflect that while that was what brought them to the group, they found that the sense of being with a group of folks who are very much in the same boat and share experiences and really I think one of the terms used is I can talk with folks and I don't have to explain myself. And so that's one of the benefits of the support group. And as I had mentioned, we're looking at support as more than something that is required or is important during the treatment process, but as something that continues on, and which is one of the reasons that we're looking at post-treatment groups. And it's a whole new direction for us as far as working with our lung cancer clients in that respect.
And do you want to say more about that? Because you've been running groups for such a long time here at Cancer Care, and people have been in your groups for a very long time. If you can say something about that, the post-treatment.
Yeah, and one of the things is that we've had post-treatment folks in the basic lung cancer survivor support group, which was people newly diagnosed in treatment or post. And one of the things is that after a while of people sitting there in post, there's so much more that is out there that they can become engaged in. And so oftentimes the reflection we've often heard about, there are no parades for lung cancer patients because people aren't around that long. And that's right. There's been a tremendous change since I started this 15 years ago in survival and the number of people we see, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years down the road. And instead of just sitting in a group, the focus is much more on extra group activity, getting involved in doing blogs, getting involved in fundraising efforts, in advocacy efforts. And it's a direction that we're kind of excited about helping people connect to.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've been just extraordinary. This has been, as one of our callers said, an extraordinary call. So I want to thank you all for being really so such wonderful speakers and so expert. And I want to also thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions either on the phone or online. That's been wonderful, always adding to the call that opportunity to hear from each of you. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so with that in mind, I, again, just want to reiterate for all of you that Cancer Care has a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we provide free services to people in a variety of those services, from practical and financial assistance to supportive counseling, someone to talk to who's a professionally trained person about your concerns individually or on the telephone, on a support group on the phone or online. We also offer these education workshops, and you all have a listing of all the upcoming programs we're offering as well. And we have all these materials and fact sheets and booklets. And we're actually here to help you. We're basically here as an organization to provide support and help to anyone who is affected by lung cancer, by cancer in general. And so I most importantly do not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of a community of support and that we are truly here to help you and that you don't have to wait till you have a crisis. You can call us at any time and really just talk with someone here about some of your concerns and or just touch base so that you know that you have a place that you can call. And our 800 number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And our website is www.cancercare.org. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.